Honors, Joseph Cicero, on behalf of the appellee, Cobalt Operating LLC. I rise to introduce my colleagues from my firm's Boston office, Ms. Barbara Moore and Ms. Wendy Catino.
Welcome to the court.
With your Honor's permission, Ms. Catino will be handling today's argument on behalf of the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, David Jenkins for appellants. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce Michelle Gott at the council table, who gave invaluable assistance on the brief. This is an unusual fraud case. It's based on the theory that my client engaged in a massive fraud to inflate artificially the revenues of the radio station, WRMF, to obtain a better price in the sale of that station. Cobalt argued, and the court below, the Court of Chancery, agreed that Crystal improperly billed for 16,000 commercials over an 18-month period immediately preceding the transfer at the end of June 2002. Why is it unusual? Well, given the breadth of the alleged fraud, and this is quite broad, 16,000 commercials over an 18-month period, there was very skimpy evidence presented to support it. There were, for example, no advertiser complaints. One might have thought that, given the number of commercials that were supposedly aired but were not aired, some advertiser would have come in and complained about the failure of their commercials to air. There's no evidence that anyone did. No witnesses testified to the fraud, even though several critical people who one would have thought would have had knowledge of the fraud were either employed by Cobalt at the time of trial or were within their control. No contemporaneous documents supported the fraud. And the post-transfer revenues of Cobalt after the sale are inconsistent with the fraud.
Can I stop you on that one?
Yes, ma'am.
In what way is it inconsistent, the revenues?
As we pointed out in the brief, there were revenues presented to Cobalt as part of the sale.
Right.
If Cobalt is correct and a massive fraud occurred, those revenues have to be discounted substantially. They didn't occur. They were fraudulent. Once you do so, and then...
Wait a second. I thought the revenues did come in. It's just that the commercials weren't played.
Correct. But if you discount for those revenues that came in based on alleged commercials that allegedly did not air, you back down to a number of commercials that did air, the so-called true revenues. Once you do that and compare it to the undisputed post-transfer revenues, you get an enormous bump between the time immediately prior to the transfer and the time immediately immediately after the transfer. That jump, 29%, simply cannot work based on the facts and evidence. We know based on the trial record that the only way you can increase revenues is twofold. You can air more commercials. Well, you couldn't do that here. That's the whole theory behind Cobalt. We didn't have the time to air the commercials. Or you could raise commercial rates. It's a simple multiplication. Trial testimony is uncontroverted. Rates were raised 15%. Commercial load, the spot load, was either stayed the same or slightly decreased. You can't keep one variable constant or maybe slightly decrease it, multiply the other by 15% and get a 29% increase in revenues. It does not work. Therefore, Your Honor, we believe that the post-transfer revenues, when compared with the pre-transfer revenues that Cobalt said must have occurred, show that the fraud could not have occurred as they alleged. Cobalt's entire case rested on two expert reports, one by a man named Graham, another by a man named Rowland. Mr. Graham was an employee of Cobalt at the time he gave his expert testimony. Mr. Rowland was a vendor to Cobalt. Neither one used the best evidence here, the so-called program logs, on which we dilated extensively in the briefs. Rather, they used a comparison between the so-called Marketron board files on the one hand and the Scott System aired files on the other hand to show what they said were this huge number of commercials that did not air. Both these expert analyses were flawed, and now I will get into that. We don't believe there's any legitimate question that the program logs were the best evidence of what actually aired each day. They start out as computer printouts, but then as changes are made every day to the schedule, either the disc jockeys or one of Crystal's employees would make handwritten changes to the program logs. They were not available at trial. Court of Chancery, recognized the importance of the program logs. If it was really a fraud, the program logs would undoubtedly show it. The Court of Chancery, however, found that these program logs were entitled to very little weight, stating that they could have been doctored, and they may have been the means by which the alleged conspirators conspired with one another or communicated with one another. This is a very important issue, because if the program logs are considered the best evidence and they're not there, that alone casts significant doubt on whether a fraud occurred. With due respect, the Court of Chancery's speculations on these two points has no factual basis. It's entirely speculative. There is no fact in the record that says that these logs were doctored, and there is no fact in the record that supports that these may have been the means by which the conspirators communicated with one another.
Well, is it correct, as a matter of fact, that the program logs by industry custom are discarded so that they simply weren't logically going to be available, no matter what quality of proof they may have added to the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes to the first part. By industry custom, they were discarded typically, and that's what happened here. However, there's one other important fact. Excuse me while I get a drink of water. It's a bit dry today. Prior to the sale, Cobalt did extensive due diligence and had an accountant who specializes in this business, a gentleman named Les Suffren, do substantial due diligence. Mr. Suffren told Cobalt, the only record of what airs is the program logs. You ought to look at them. You ought to keep them. Cobalt's trial witnesses acknowledged they received this report from Mr. Suffren and did not do so. So if there's a problem anywhere with the program logs, the last clear chance, so to speak, was Cobalt, which was warned they should keep them and did not. And these program logs, the Cobalt alleges that the fraud continued for the first 3 months or so after it purchased the station. They were the sole ones in control of the station at that time and could have kept the program logs.
Are you suggesting that's analogous to knowing there's a live witness not taking the deposition and then the witness dies and is unavailable, and yet everyone agrees that witness's testimony would have been the best evidence to resolve the issues at trial?
That's certainly an analogy, Your Honor. I mean, as I said, I call it the last clear chance. It's not quite as in an automobile accident, but Cobalt was on notice of the importance of these and did nothing to keep them. And now they're the ones claiming fraud. It's their burden of proof, and they did not have the program logs.
So the price was computed as 14 times revenue. Is that right?
14 times something called broadcast cash flow.
All right. And so when they were determining the broadcast cash flow, were the program logs relevant to that computation?
Yes, in an indirect sense as follows. That is, you had numbers that Mr. Suffren was going through the finances of Cobalt prior to the sale. And he came up with a lot of problems with, the finances of Crystal prior to the sale. He came up with a lot of problems with them. One of the things he specifically looked at is there proof that all these number of commercials, without commercials, you have no revenue for the station, essentially. Did all these number of commercials air? He was focused right on that issue. And he found out that the program logs were the only ones that could support that. If you had the program logs, you could run down and determine, yes, the commercials air. Yes, that supports these revenues. So I think the answer is yes, Your Honor, but it's indirect in the way I just described.
Well, how are they finding the cash flow to use as the multiplier? And then in this case, Vice Chancellor Strine concluded there was an $11 million problem. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what were they using to multiply by 14? How did they determine that?
It was the so-called broadcast cash flow.
I understand.
All right.
That. But is this actual cash? Is there some kind of accrual component to that?
I don't believe that there's an accrual component to the cash flow, except that, this would be an accrual business, so the cash flow would be, yes, there would be an accrual component.
Well, the reason
component
I ask that is because the suggestion is with the colorful cartoon in the opinion and other things that it was impossible for the disc jockeys to do the number of commercials that were projected. And yet the suggestion in the briefs and in the case is somehow these commercials that were impossible to air were taken into consideration when the multiplier was used to come up with the price of the station.
There's several ways. There's a couple of points I could make in there, Your Honor. First, yes, the colorful photograph in the opinion of Rosemary Woods was to illustrate what the Court of Chancery understood was one of our defenses about how these commercials could be played in one way. That was not our argument at trial. Our argument was twofold. Number one, there was a substantial gap in the so-called Scott system aired files. The basis for the only basis for the damage reports were the so-called Scott system aired files. The person who analyzed these, Mr. Graham, said initially on direct, every minute of every day is accounted for. In cross-examination, he had to acknowledge that's not true, so there's a two-hour gap. So there's sufficient time in the day to put these commercials in. We also had evidence that showed that there were occasions when something was not aired through the Scott system aired files. The Scott system aired files could have made a mistake, for example, or something that was pre-recorded, and a pre-recorded commercial was changed to a so-called live read at the last minute, or the pre-recorded commercial only came in at the last minute, or there were last-minute changes, and the disc jockeys had to play them through a CD. But not stretching across the room as Rosemary Woods did. The CD is right on the console. They can stick it in right there and play it. So there were ways to so there was evidence at trial to show that, yes, these commercials could have been played. The Court of Chancery ignored that. The way this backs into the broadcast cash flow is, if the commercials played and the revenue was really received, then there were no damages to plaintiffs. That's how it backs into that, Your Honor.
Well, those are two different things, though, aren't they? You might get the money even if the commercial didn't play, although someone might be upset after the fact to find out their commercial didn't play.
Correct.
Were both of those issues resolved in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not understanding the distinction between the two issues.
Well, if I pay you for a commercial, you get my money.
Right.
But I may never get the commercial because it's impossible to do it in the time, and yet the money's there. But if I find that out later, I'm not going to let you do that to me twice, so the revenue will be less in the future.
Correct. That was, I am assuming that was the theory on which the damage award was based. They took this number 14, which I will get to in a moment, times the difference between the actual broadcast cash flow, that is the numbers that Crystal reported at Cobalt, and what the court determined were, the actual cash coming in and what it should have come in based on the actual commercials that were aired. But the 14 number, this is the basis for the damages, is not nearly as solid as the Court of Chancery allowed. If I could turn to that for just a second, please. There's no magic to this 14 broadcast cash flow figure. There's no contemporaneous document that supports it. Crystal never based its asking price on a multiple of cash flow. No contemporaneous document supports Cobalt's trial testimony that showed how it valued the radio station. There's no evidence that both parties agreed on this. That is, sometimes in the purchase agreement you'll say, we're going to value this at 14 times broadcast cash flow, whatever that turns out to be. That's not in any of the documents, including the asset purchase agreement. The only thing that supports that is the unsupported trial testimony of Cobalt's witnesses, which is, to say the least, extremely self-interested.
Was this like an algebraic equation where you know the answer and then you need to put a multiplier on the other side to come up with the answer? You're saying that the 14 was originated with the expert as something that would justify the agreed price, but really had nothing to do with what the parties negotiated.
Yes, that is our point, Your Honor. When you look at the trial testimony, the equity, Cobalt had to borrow money to get the deal done. Its equity financier, a man named Mr. Gormley, he testified. When he was brought into the deal at first, the $70 million purchase price had been established, and the cash flow was expected to be $5 million. This is before Mr. Suffren's adjustments. So he never went in saying, I have to have 14 times broadcast cash flow. It was, as Your Honor said, you back into that number with what you're presented. Now, what Mr. Suffren did is he looked and said, this $5 million cash flow just doesn't exist. There's nothing improper about that. There were a number of radio stations being run together. And as long as they're being run together, the expenses were muddled together, I think. Mr. Suffren said, you've got to make some changes here. When he made those changes, the broadcast cash flow goes down to something a little less than $4 million. Well, $4 million into 70 isn't 14. It's more like 18. Cobalt didn't back out of the deal then. They redid the components of the deal to bring in a promissory note, but they didn't reduce the purchase price.
And those were the two things that the vice chancellor, in effect, canceled when he was computing the actual damages.
Yes, he canceled the promissory note that I just spoke about and also canceled an equity interest in Cobalt.
Can you explain to me what you mean by unsupported trial testimony? I understand when the judge's conclusion is unsupported by the testimony. What is unsupported trial testimony?
There are no contemporaneous documents that supported it, Your Honor. The witnesses did get on the stand to testify, sort of. It was what I was talking with Justice Holland about. That is, you back into the issue. But there were no contemporaneous documents that say this 14 times broadcast cash flow had any importance whatsoever. Indeed, there's no documents that talk about any multiple broadcast cash flow or something else, any metric or any multiple whatsoever. This just wasn't the way the deal was done.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would like to, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Wendy Catino, and I represent the appellees in this case. The first thing that my brother said to you was that there's skimpy evidence, that there's no advertiser complaints, that there's no witnesses to testify to the fraud, and no contemporaneous documents, and that the post-trial revenues are inconsistent with the fraud. Every one of those factual findings was already rejected by the Court of Chancery. And more importantly, the fact that each one of Crystal's witnesses, which totaled about six, came to the Court of Chancery and told the same story that the Court of Chancery found to be misleading and false is evidence in and of itself of the fraud. My brother has argued that in the briefs, and not so much in the argument today, that the trial court shifted the burden to Crystal to prove. That is simply not the case. The court, in multiple locations in its memorandum opinion, says that it was skeptical of Cobalt's fraud claims and that it scrutinized them carefully. And only after it scrutinized those claims did it find that Cobalt met all the burdens of proof that it was required to meet. Not only did it meet the burden of proof on fraud, it met the burden of proof on a breach of contract as well, which has never been addressed by Crystal. Only when the court found that Cobalt had met its burden of proof did the court attempt to go through the laundry list of excuses as to why these commercials allegedly aired. And the court did so in fashion, one after the other. And in fact, the court found that indeed Crystal's defenses in this regard were largely contradicted by the testimony of its own witnesses. It further said that there were no compelling defenses presented, and none of the defenses presented weakened the compelling evidence of fraud presented by the Cobalt.
Well, in your view, what does the record reflect on how the parties arrived at the $70 million price?
It is uncontested. Two witnesses testified for Cobalt, Mr. Michael Kutchell and Mr. Stephen Gormley. Michael Kutchell was the president of the entity, and he suggested the $70 million price to Hilliard months before Mr. Gormley ever arrived on the scene. And he testified in his deposition in that trial that he told Mr. Hilliard that it was a multiple of broadcast cash flow. And so he asked Mr. Hilliard, what is your broadcast cash flow? And Mr. Hilliard told him $5 million. From that, he took the multiple that was the going rate multiple for radio stations in the industry at that time, which was 14, and he multiplied it to get $70 million. Mr. Gormley also testified that that was the maximum multiple that he was willing to pay and that he was required to have $5 million to pay the $70 million purchase price because for two reasons, for his own personal assessment of the value of the station, but also he needed to get $30 million in debt financing. And at that time, it is uncontested from Mr. Gormley's testimony that debt financers at that point in time were using a 6x broadcast cash flow to lend. And so he needed that $30 million to justify the purchase price.
Well, and I'd like you to address Mr. Jenkins' point that when the due diligence was being conducted, it turned out that the cash flow, if you stayed with the same price, would result in a multiplier of 18 rather than 14. And then we have these two pieces of the consideration that were changed, and yet the total consideration stayed at 70, but it would be an 18 rather than 14 multiplier. How do you respond to that?
I'm happy to do that. The adjustments that were made that my brother has referenced were adjustments to Crystal's 2001 cash flow, finances. They backed out $1 million of expenses, and so their broadcast cash flow was $4 million, closer to four than five. The deal had always been, what is your cash flow at the day of closing? And in this particular case, Mr. Hilliard, the principal of Crystal, required my clients to sign an APA before they would be allowed to set foot into the door to do due diligence. And the deal was always that at closing, you had to have broadcast cash flow of $5 million. And the trailing 12 months cash flow, which has been presented in the briefs as Appendix A328, shows that as of May 31st, 2002, the last trailing 12 months, there was approximately $5 million in cash flow. And therefore, on that basis alone, the deal closed. And Mr. Gormley testified that had it not been $5 million, he would have walked away from the deal. And that position is justified by the contractual language of the APA, which specifically says that my clients had the option to walk away if they did not get the financing that they were expected to get. And so it's not an issue of that it was really $4 million. It was represented always from the beginning of the deal to the end of the deal as $5 million, and that's where the purchase price came from.
So, and how would you describe the fraud that occurred? What did they do and how did they do it?
It's actually very simple, and it ties into the issue of the best evidence that was raised here. The program logs are not the best evidence of what the fraud is that we have alleged. The program logs show everything that was aired, all the notes, all the live reads, all the banter, notes about changing things around, notes about adding things in. Our fraud claim is based exclusively on pre-recorded digital commercials that had a number in the system. There's a Marketron system that schedules and a Scott system that airs. And those numbers carry through. So when you schedule a pre-recorded commercial in Marketron, it gets a CM number, CM designation, commercial matter, with a number that corresponds with the copy that's attached to it, the digital file that's attached to it. And once it's scheduled in Marketron, Marketron talks to Scott, and Scott airs that automatically. The fraud is based exclusively on the fact that there are these pre-recorded commercials that the court found every witness, including their own experts, agreed that these CM commercials that are the basis of our fraud claim would have shown up on the aired file if, in fact, they did air. And for that reason, the best evidence of whether or not they aired is the Scott files that log whether or not such commercials aired.
Now, does the record reflect that those were paid for even though they did not air?
Absolutely. The Marketron board files contain scheduling information and whether or not that was invoiced. And those records have never been challenged at trial. And those comparing what was invoiced, the CM numbers that were invoiced, with the CM numbers that aired, there are 16,000 more that were invoiced than were aired. And that is the simple basis of the fraud claim. And that analysis, which the court found credible and reliable, and in fact found that the Scott system itself was credible and reliable, was never rebutted by the appellants in this case, here or at trial. You have not heard them say that they can point to one commercial that was allegedly not aired when we say it wasn't aired.
So your theory is that the advertisers were being billed for commercials that were so many that they were physically impossible to air, and yet because they were paying for them until they found out their commercials weren't airing, it artificially inflated the revenue at a time when they were computing the purchase price.
Yes, and it would be impossible for my clients to match that revenue because we weren't fraudulently billing people up to 60 commercials a day that didn't air. And there is compelling evidence that these commercials didn't air, aside from what I've just told you. My two witnesses, my experts, presented, and I do call Dale Graham an expert in the sense that he was the most familiar with the Scott system. He installed it in the radio station, and he worked on it, and he understood how it worked. But there's two things that make it compelling that these commercials didn't air. We presented multiple examples of commercials that they allegedly said aired and that they billed clients for, and when you take the aired file and they say this commercial aired, CM1000 aired at 8 a.m., and you look at the aired file for 8 a.m., and a song is playing. It could not possibly have happened. In addition, we took a bunch of invoices, and we looked at all of them, and we took a day, and we looked at all, we said, here's the bad billings. Here's what we agree are good billings. And when you take the bad billings and the good billings, and you put them together, and you look at the aired file, and it adds up to more than 60 minutes an hour. That is a physical impossibility. They could not have aired those in the hour that they said they did, or it would have been more than 64 minutes of content in some of these hours.
Can I ask you to give us an answer on a related question, which is, since this has been described as a fairly massive fraud, one would think that advertisers would be right on top of it, that you know, in the industry, one would think that it's the kind of concern every advertiser would have. Oh, we're paying for this. Are we going to have somebody actually sit there and listen to all the different stations that we advertise on 24 hours a day to make sure that every one of them gets played? Why didn't that either come out as, you know, here are the advertisers and here's how they all complained about being defrauded, or, you know, here's why they wouldn't have caught it?
Because the fraud was done in a way that was ingenious. They focused on national advertisers, and they took national advertisers that would bill, that would order 20 commercials in a month, and they would air 18 of them, but they wouldn't air two of them, and they would bill those two. You multiply that over multiple advertisers over multiple months, and it adds up to 16,000.
And well, I understand how you could do the billing and so forth. What I'm having trouble with is that, since, to me at least, it seems like a pretty simple thing that a radio station could be doing all the time. Aren't there checks and balances built into from the advertiser's side that would keep this from happening?
There are, but the fact of the matter that they particularly preyed on national advertisers is important to the question that you just asked. Both Mr. Kutchel, the president of the radio station, and Tim Reaver, who's the sales manager for Crystal, testified that national advertisers do not listen to commercials spots in Florida. So if the advertising agency is in New York, they're not listening to every single commercial in Florida. And so if someone is spot checking, yeah, they're going to hear their ads. They're not going to know that 2 out of 18 played. And that testimony about the fact that it's mostly national advertisers can be gleaned by the court themselves by taking a look at the bad billings analysis. And you can see the name of the advertisers. They're Home Depot, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, AT&T, Verizon, these types of ads. These aren't mom and pops who played one ad a month and everyone sat around by the radio and waited for the commercial to be played. These are national advertisers. And the testimony about the nature of the majority of the bad billings analysis was accepted by the court, was testified by two witnesses, and was not rebutted by the defendants in any manner. I would like to turn, because my time is starting to run short, to something that I think is that you opened the questioning with, which is, why isn't it possible? Why couldn't they have done it? And that's exactly the point. Their analysis is that the post-sales revenue negates the fraud. Well, the post-sale revenue is talking about dollars coming in. It does not touch the fact that our analysis was based on computer-generated logs. One has nothing to do with the other. But in addition, the premise is completely false. They suggest that there's a 29% bump in revenue between 2002 and 2003. But I urge the court to look at the figure upon which the 2002 revenue was based. It was not my client's 2002 revenue. It was the trailing 12 months revenue. And if you look at it, the citation for the number that they pick is A328. That's trailing 12 months from May 31st, 2002 back.
So are you saying that this 29% included payments made for commercials that did not air because it was coming in, you know, kind of in arrears?
Correct. And they try, well, it includes payments for spots that did not air. They tried to correct for this by backing out the bad billings number out of it. The problem is it's not 2002's number. It only goes to May 31st, 2002. Those are Crystal's revenues. We didn't take possession of the station until July. And so the 2002 number that they cite does not include the last 6 months that we were operating the radio station for that year, and it doesn't include the fact that we added revenue from July on at a 15% higher rate. It just doesn't, the number is artificially deflated as a result of that. So they're taking an artificially deflated number that isn't even our 2002 revenue, and they do not show 2002 revenue in their briefs anywhere. And they're comparing it to a full year, 2003, of billing at a higher rate. That's going to create
your 15% increase.
They say it's 29% increase, and I'm telling you that number is false.
You increased what you were charging by 15% of what they were charging, which could have led to part of the 29% increase.
It could have led to all of it, and the reason why it could have led to all of it is because the court found that how much you can charge depends on the mix of commercial spots that you play. So if you don't give away any ads, which the court found that Crystal did, and if you are doing better and your ratings are higher, which they were after the transfer, and if you're making more efforts to sell better commercials, which the court found that they were, you can put in the 16 to 18 minute slots that you have the highest billing spots. So even though the rates across the board from the 30-second commercial to the 60-second commercial have increased 15%, if you put all of the highest billing in those spots, you can get 29%.
So the national advertisers always monitor your market share, and they're willing to pay more depending on who you're reaching at the peak period.
Absolutely, and Mike Cutchell testified about that dynamic. And the fact of the matter is that they didn't put any evidence in to say what we were billing, who we were billing, how many spots precisely we were billing, and what the rates we were getting for it. So that's important. The other important thing that makes their calculation simply voodoo economics is they fail to back out the barter revenue that wasn't recognized at trial. So when we took over the station, we recognized barter revenue as revenue, which was appropriate to do. Crystal never recognized their barter revenue and never put their barter revenue on their financials. Appellate counsel tries to fix this error on appeal by backing out Cobalt's barter revenue from the trailing 12 months figure. That's not even 2002 to begin with. And backing out Cobalt's barter doesn't fix the problem that they don't add Crystal's barter number to Crystal's number that they're comparing. So they're artificially deflating the 2002 number in two different ways to compare it to a 2003 number. The premise is false and the math is false. And as I said before, that fact doesn't change the finding that there was fraud in this case. And the calculation of damages that occurred in this case was testified to by one person, our expert, Peter Handy. They had an expert notice for trial and decided not to call him. They presented no evidence to rebut the valuation testimony, and so the only thing the transfer court had to work from was its own analysis guided by Peter Handy's expert testimony, which he found to be credible and reliable. The other issue that I have with both trial counsel and appellate counsel trying to create a damages analysis using the 2001 revenues by Crystal, the financial statements, and the post-sale statements is that everyone admits that the pre-sale revenue figures were calculated in a manner not compliant with GAAP. And everybody admits that post-sale there were audited financials compliant with GAAP. You can't take two non-compliant revenues and compare it with GAAP financial revenues and suggest that it's just a simple math error, a simple math equation. It's not. Backing out barter doesn't account for the fact that Cobalt's expenses also increased. Cobalt paid its employees by bartering for revenue. So they said, sorry, Crystal paid its employees by bartering for revenue. So they said, local car company, we will agree to pay put 20 spots on the air if you give us a BMW for our sales manager. They never recorded that as an expense, and that's not adjusted for by the analysis that has been done by appellant counsel, not by a single witness in this case. There's also a host of other issues that make Crystal's financials not compliant with GAAP that they have failed to address either in argument or with trial testimony. I also think it's important for this court to recognize that the credibility assessments made by the Court of Chancery have traditionally been afforded substantial deference by this court. And in that light, the court said, as to Crystal's witnesses, it's telling that Russ Morley, who was Crystal's program director and DJ, was the only believable witness presented by Crystal, and he described his daily broadcast practices as being completely in line with the picture painted by Cobalt. That's important because Russ Morley took...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Three points, Your Honors. Number one, on these post-transfer revenues, Ms. Catino says we did not adjust expenses. You don't touch expenses when you're dealing with revenues. This is not cash flow I'm talking about, it's revenues. Number two, she suggests that we improperly handled barter revenue. Below, barter revenue was not properly done. On appeal, we can just work off the financial statements and adjust it. We did back out barter revenue from Cobalt's post-transfer revenues to get an apples-to-apples comparison, and those are the numbers in the briefs. What we did on the trailing 12 months, I believe Ms. Catino, I'm sure, not deliberately, slightly mischaracterized what we did. You have a break-off point of June 30th, 2002. That's when the transfer occurs. So we looked at what were the revenues in the trailing 12 months prior to June 30th, 2002. It's Crystal's revenues. And what were Cobalt's revenues immediately after the sale? That's the 29% jump if you back out the bad billings analysis, and that you can't do. It just doesn't work out. Ms. Catino attempted to explain that by saying, oh, well, we did a much better job of doing things. Yes, they did. They were able to raise revenues by 15%. But as I said earlier, commercial revenues are number of ads times rates. If the ads are being kept constant or slightly down, which is what the trial testimony is, you're raising rates by 15%, you cannot come to a 29% bump, which means that the fraud, as they describe, based on their own financials, could not have occurred. Let me touch on the national advertisers, which she talked about. No one brought in, their argument is that national advertisers, if they were not listening to their ads, again, they have the burden of proof, they did not bring in any national advertiser to talk about that. So we point out in the brief, the two people who talked about this, we're both speculating. Neither were national advertisers. Neither had talked to national advertisers. Both of them speculated, gee, I doubt that the national advertisers listened to us. This is not typically the sort of testimony you would rely upon in an area of this importance. And again, the importance is that there is so little facts to support the fraud that they claim. Ms. Catino did not mention that when she's talking about there's no witnesses here. There are two critical witnesses who Cobalt had control over, they did not call. Chet Tart, who was the general manager of the station beginning several months before the transfer, and Mr. Krieger, who was their national sales manager, the boss of Lisa Colson, the person whom, according to Cobalt, ran the fraud. Both of them were either in the employ of Cobalt at time of trial or could have been called by Cobalt. Mr. Tart had an agreement in his contract that he would come in to testify. Neither were called to testify. Mighty unusual if the fraud of this massive scale is going on, if those people don't have evidence to support it, and you have to assume that because they weren't called, what's going on here? My final point is on the pre-recorded commercials where Ms. Catino says it could not possibly have happened that the commercials that were billed for but they claim were not aired could have been aired. With respect, that is incorrect. Goes back again to their expert, Mr. Graham, who initially said, my analysis counts for every minute, every second of every day. On cross-examination, he had to concede that was not so. There's our expert, who talked about the matter and was unrebutted, said there's 2 hours on average missing out of each day, and sometimes it's much more. That is 2 hours of material recorded in the Scott System error files. I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear. The Scott System error files only recorded 22 hours a day. The remaining 2 hours on average is plenty of time to put in these commercials. And we have set forth in the brief how it could have been done. That is, Scott System error files were not necessarily complete, and it is clear that material that came in, such as changes of recorded commercials to live reads and last-minute recorded commercials, would not have aired through the Scott System error files. That's all I have. Your Honors, if any questions, I will attempt to answer them.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank
we'll
you,
take the case under advisement and recess.